Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Monday, the 25th of March, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Carol Lockhart and Jeff Cassett. Here's Carol with our first story.
Hello, everyone. From the local pages, in Moline, Riverside Park, Phase 2 parking begins on Monday. Starting Monday, Riverside Park Phase 2 parking will begin in Moline. The cemetery area between the one-ways on 5th Avenue will be closed to replace the asphalt. The road that runs in front of the Riverside Mausoleum will be closed to add additional parking on either side of the road. People will be able to access the pickleball courts and tennis courts during this time. The work is part of the Riverside Legacy project that was proposed in the fall of 2021. Last summer, Riverside Pool underwent $6,825,300 worth of updates and improvements, including 3 water slides, a lazy river, a splash pad, new shade structures, updated concessions, nighttime lights, a shared park shelter, and family restrooms. The pool is expected to reopen this summer. During a city council meeting in September, Parks and Recreation Director Eric Griffith also outlined to aldermen a few possible renovations to the court, resurfacing $170,000, tile court $369,000, rubberized surface for $416,000, new asphalt courts for about $1.2 million, or new concrete courts at about $1.3 million. Griffith told the council at the time that the tennis courts have received repaving and repainting over the years and have 2 layers of asphalt on top of what it used to be. Jeff?
Get your umbrellas out. Needed rain is on the way. The weather system may bring 2 inches of rain to the Quad Cities area. A storm system that blanketed parts of California with snow will bring much-needed rain to eastern Iowa on Monday and Tuesday, according to the National Weather Service in Davenport. Meteorologist Brian Pierce said the Quad City region specifically, and most of Iowa in general, would be in the warm part of the system, while there were blizzard warnings out for northwest Kansas and the western part of Nebraska. Colder air moves into the region on Tuesday, bringing a chance of snow, but no accumulations are expected. For the most part, we'll stay on the warm side of the system with a chance of thunderstorms, Pierce said. The immediate metro area, as well as a line from Maquoketa to Burlington, can expect between 1 and 1.5 inches from the system, while west of the Quad Cities, from Waterloo to Cedar Rapids to Iowa City, can expect from 0.5 to 1 inch of rain from the system, he said. Rain totals are expected to be higher east of the Mississippi, with a possibility of 1.5 to 2 inches of rain falling along a line from Macomb to Galesburg to Sterling to Freeport, he added. Monday's forecast calls for a 90% chance of rain, with new rain amounts up to 0.75 inches possible. There's a 100% chance of rain on Monday night, with up to an additional 0.75 inches of rain possible. Pierce said the high temperature Tuesday would reach into the lower 50s during the morning hours before much colder air moves through the region. There's a 70% chance of rain and snow on Tuesday, with an overnight low Wednesday of 24 degrees. The high Wednesday is expected to reach 42 degrees under sunny skies, while the overnight low into Thursday will be about 26. Temperatures will rebound on Thursday with a high of 54 degrees under sunny skies. Pierce said the rain was badly needed as the Quad City region was abnormally dry, while the areas to the west ranged from severe drought to extreme drought. Because of the cloud cover, a penumbral lunar eclipse that is to occur on Monday night will not be visible. A penumbral lunar eclipse occurs when the moon dims slightly as it passes through the outer edge of the Earth's shadow. At this time of year, the full moon is known as the worm moon, as earthworms begin appearing with the warmer weather, according to the National Weather Service. In the extended forecast, Friday is expected to be partly sunny with a high of 64 degrees. Saturday is expected to be sunny with a high of 63. Easter Sunday in the Quad Cities is expected to be partly sunny with a high of 59 and a 30% chance of rain. According to the National Weather Service Climate Prediction Center, the Quad City region can expect normal temperatures and rainfall through April 7th. Normal high temperatures for this point in March range from 54 degrees on Monday to 57 degrees by Sunday. Normal rainfall for March is 2.62 inches, while normal snowfall is 4.4. Carol, back to you.
Thank you, Jeff. And nonprofit schedules Fit Fest fundraiser in Davenport. Project Renewal, a nonprofit with a focus on children in Central Davenport, is sponsoring a Fit Fest fundraiser on Saturday, April 20th, to support its summer programs and to promote exercise. The fest will be from 9 to 11 a.m. in Sister Conchetta Park at 6th and Warren Streets, and will consist of 10 challenges to complete with a partner. Packet pickups with T-shirts will be from 5 to 6 p.m. on April 19th, or at 8 a.m. on April 20th at 510 Warren Street. Registration is $20, with children ages 12 and under competing free. Project Renewal also is looking for individuals or companies to make sponsorship donations. For more information, contact Project Renewal at 563-324-0800 or go online to projectrenewal.net. Registration and checks should be mailed to Project Renewal at 906 West 5th Street in Davenport, Iowa, 52802. Summer programs that will be made possible by donations include field trips, academic support in reading, math, and writing, swim lessons, and nutritional programs. In addition to Fit Fest, Project Renewal is sponsoring a free 6-week program for girls and women who want to walk or run to strengthen mental health, physical fitness, make friends, and have fun. Participants will meet at 6 p.m. Mondays, April 18th through May 13th at the River's Edge. The address is 700 West River Drive in Davenport. Leaders will help pace each group, and there will be guest speakers. Jeff?
Local headline, Davenport. Police investigate a shots fired incident. Davenport police are investigating a shots fired incident that occurred early Sunday. Officers responded to the 700 block of Iowa Street at 12:13 a.m. to investigate a report of shots fired. A Chevrolet Cruze fled from police. However, officers were able to bring the vehicle to a stop on West 7th Street, just west of Warren. A juvenile was taken into custody. There were no reports of injuries. The incident remains under investigation. And also, local news, Port Byron. A man killed in UTV crash. A 53-year-old Port Byron man died Friday after the utility task vehicle, or UTV, he was riding crashed. Rock Island County Sheriff Darren Hart reported. Deputies were sent to the 1200 block of 9th Avenue about 10:27 p.m. and located a man trapped under an overturned UTV. Life-saving measures were attempted but were unsuccessful, Hart said. Rock Island County Coroner Brian Gustafson identified the man as Scott E. Weaver, Sr. Hart said that two other men were on the UTV and they suffered minor injuries in the crash. The Illinois State Police, Illinois Conservation Police, Port Byron Rapid City Fire Protection District, and Genesis EMS assisted at the scene. The crash remains under investigation by the Rock Island County Sheriff's Department. Carol.
Thank you, Jeff. And here's where to go for karaoke. There's nothing like a night of karaoke. It's the casual music listener's chance to become a rock star for 3 or 4 minutes. Liquid Courage, optional. Whether your go-to karaoke song is Mr. Brightside or You Oughta Know, it's always a good time. So where can you sing karaoke in the Quad Cities? At Boozy's. This downtown Davenport spot is a surefire killer karaoke time. The Bar and Grill is located at 114 West 3rd Street and open daily until midnight and until 2 a.m. on Friday and Saturday. The second floor dance area is a popular spot for the younger college-age crowd, but downstairs is eclectic. On a visit, there were both Taylor Swift and Kansas. The drinks are cheap, and on college football game days, they're even cheaper. Karaoke is hosted at Boozy's on Fridays and Saturdays starting at 9:30 a.m. At the Broken Saddle, with its eclectic decor and melting pot of guests, there's something for everyone at the saloon-themed Broken Saddle in Moline. The pub's walls are covered with beer memorabilia, patriotic flags, and pop culture references. Because of that range, this is another spot where you can get away with almost any song. With visits yielding I Don't Want to Miss a Thing by Aerosmith, Bringing the House Down, moments before Whitney Houston's I Want to Dance with Somebody. According to its website, Broken Saddle hosts karaoke Wednesday through Saturday from 9 p.m. until 2 a.m., with the bar closing at 3 a.m. It can be found at 1417 5th Avenue in Moline. And their third suggestion is the Raccoon Motel. Karaoke is a newer addition to Raccoon Motel's roster. While the concert venue has hosted acts like Orville Peck, Claude, and Raylan Baxter in the past, it's now open for amateurs on occasional weekdays for Raccoon Karaoke. No pressure, but at Raccoon Motel's karaoke nights, you will take a perch at the front of the venue, high above your fellow bar goers. No pressure for the karaoke experts, but this one is not for the stage fright inclined. Raccoon Motel is located at 315 East 2nd Street in downtown Davenport. Stay up to date when the venue is hosting karaoke nights through their social media at Raccoon Motel on Instagram. Jeff?
Renovations begin in Rock Island. Construction forces some offices and meetings to move. With renovations to Rock Island City Hall set to begin April 1st, City Council meetings and study sessions will move into the County Boardroom starting on Monday, today. The County Boardroom is located on the third floor of the County Office Building at 1504 3rd Street. The building is right next to Rock Island City Hall. The city's permits and inspection service counter has been moved to the third floor of City Hall. The offices of the City Clerk, the mayor, and city manager have moved to the east side of the building and can be accessed through the 16th Street entrance. The $2.2 million project is being mostly funded through the American Rescue Plan Act, or ARPA, with $250,000 coming from a surplus in the city's general fund. City Council members approved the project in October of 2022. Improvements include the redesign and reconstruction of City Council chambers, the mayor's office, and the administrative area, as well as the installation of a primary service counter for the mayor and city manager's offices. Additionally, there will be a redesign of the service counter for the Economic Development Department and conversion of a first-floor restroom into an ADA or Americans with Disabilities Act accessible restroom. City Hall was designed in 1938 by Servin and Stur in the Art Deco style and built in 1940. This will be the first major renovation since its construction. Streamline Architects performed the design services while Valley Construction was selected as construction manager. Project costs include $68,000 for design services, $47,000 for asbestos abatement, $1.6 million for construction, $250,000 for audio and visual equipment, $200,000 for furniture and fixtures, and $69,000 for contingency costs. Carol?
And from the front page, trio of suspects admit guilt in the concert hall shooting in Russia. Three of the four suspects charged with carrying out the concert hall attack in Moscow that killed more than 130 people admitted guilt for the incident in a Russian court on Sunday. Moscow's Basnany District Court formally charged Dale Redzon Mirzovsky, 32, Said Sadakrami Rachabaladoza, 30, Mohammed Sober Fayez, 19, and Shamsuddin Faraduni, 25, with committing a group terrorist attack resulting in the death of others. The offense carries a maximum sentence of life imprisonment. The court ordered that the men, all Tajikistan, however you pronounce that, folks, Tajikistan citizens, be held in pre-trial custody until May 22nd. Mirziev, Rachabaladezoza, and Samsudin Faraduni all admitted guilt after being charged. The fourth, Fazov, was brought to court directly from a hospital in a wheelchair and sat with his eyes closed throughout the proceedings. He was attended by medics while in court, where he wore a hospital gown and trousers and was seen with multiple cuts. The other three suspects appeared in court heavily bruised with swollen faces amid reports in Russian media that they were tortured during interrogation by the security services. One suspect, Sadra Kamri Rachabaladoza, had a heavily bandaged ear, Russian media reported Saturday, and one of the suspects had his ear cut off during interrogation. The Associated Press could not verify the report or the videos which purported to show this. The attack Friday on the suburban Crocus City Hall concert venue killed at least 137 people. Russian authorities arrested the four suspects Saturday, with seven more detained on suspicion of involvement in the attack. Russian President Vladimir Putin said in a nighttime address to the nation on Saturday. He claimed they were captured while fleeing to Ukraine, something that Kiev firmly denies. An affiliate of the Islamic State group claimed responsibility for the attack, the deadliest on Russian soil in years, U.S. intelligence officials said. They confirmed the IS affiliate's claim. Relatives and friends of those still missing waited for news of their loved ones as Russia observed a day of national mourning on Sunday. Events at cultural institutions were canceled, flags lowered to half staff, and television, entertainment, and advertising were suspended, according to state news agency RIA Novosti. A steady stream of people added to a makeshift memorial near the burnt-out concert hall, creating a huge mound of flowers. The Moscow region's Emergency Situations Ministry posted a video Sunday showing equipment dismantling the damaged music venue to give rescuers access. Moscow's Department of Health said Sunday it began identifying the bodies of those killed via DNA testing, which will take at least 2 weeks. Igor Pagadev desperately sought any details of his wife's whereabouts after she went to the concert and stopped responding to his messages. He had not seen a message from Yana Pagadeva since she sent him 2 photos from the music venue. After Pagadev saw the reports of the gunman opening fire on the concert goers, he rushed to the site, but could not find her in the ambulances or among the hundreds of people who made their way out of the venue. He said, "I went around, searched, I asked everyone, I showed photographs. No one saw anything, no one could say anything," Pagadev told the AP in a video message. He watched flames bursting out of the building as he made frantic calls to a hotline for relatives of the victims, but received no information. As the death toll mounted on Saturday, Pagadev scoured hospitals in the Russian capital and the Moscow region, looking for information on newly admitted patients. Jeff?
In the Viewpoint column, here are some takeaways from the primaries in Illinois. If you blinked, it's very possible you could have missed Tuesday's primary election. The occasion was largely uneventful, with the majority party presidential candidates already determined, no other statewide races to decide, and in many places, no competitive local races to motivate voters. Despite this, there are some takeaways from the results, which did include a robust Republican congressional primary in southern Illinois and some state legislative races that tested the political clout of the state's powerful unions and legislative leaders. Here are some thoughts on the outcomes and their implications going forward. Boss wins, but GOP can't rid itself of Bailey. On paper, U.S. Representative Mike Bost had every advantage a candidate could want. The Murfreesboro Republican had campaign cash to spend, the backing of key conservative interest groups like the National Rifle Association, and perhaps most importantly, the endorsement of former President Donald Trump. Despite this, rival Darren Bailey still came within a few thousand votes of knocking off the 5-time incumbent in Illinois' 12th congressional district. Of course, Bailey was not just any challenger. He had significant name recognition and residual popularity in the region from his failed run for governor in 2022 and his time as a state lawmaker. Those factors helped to somewhat neutralize the usual advantage of incumbency for Bost. Attempts to paint Bost as a liberal, quote, Republican in name only, a strategy that has worked for some candidates in other GOP primaries, rang hollow. He's a conservative who firmly embraced Trump and shares many policy positions with Bailey. The only significant difference was stylistic. Bost cast himself as a governing conservative, whereas Bailey promised to be a disruptor who would refuse to compromise on hardline positions. Think Florida Representative Matt Gaetz or Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. For Illinois Republican political operatives I spoke with during the day Tuesday, believed Boss would pull it out and lamented that it would likely be too close to count as a repudiation of Bailey and thus relegate him to the dustbin of history. And that's exactly what happened. By coming within a few thousand votes, Bailey and those of his ilk proved that they have some staying power within today's Republican Party. In a Facebook message to his supporters on Thursday, Bailey said that his campaign would pick up yard signs, adding that we will collect those and put those in storage. Sounds like a man ready to run another campaign. And in 2026, he'll have his choice of a rematch with Bost, another run for governor, or perhaps even a campaign for the U.S. Senate. It seems fairly certain that we haven't seen the last of Bailey, and that does not necessarily bode well for those who want to see the government govern. It's also not a great sign for Illinois Republicans looking to steer the party back to the center and, by extension, relevance in a state that has increasingly moved in a more progressive direction overall. Second point, the far-right lawmakers teach unions a lesson. The state's powerful teachers' unions thought they could teach far-right state representatives Adam Nymerg from Dietrich and Blaine Willhauer from Beecher City a lesson by bankrolling primary challenges for each. But in the end, they were the ones who got schooled. Willhauer easily defeated union-backed challenger Matt Hall, scoring nearly 79% of the vote. Nymerg, in his write-in campaign, beat labor-recruited challenger Jim Acklin, posting 87%, according to preliminary results. Incumbents rarely lose elections, and these two represent legislative districts that rank among the state's most conservative. Their winning was not a surprise, but the blowout margins were. The decisive victories came after the Illinois Education Association and the Illinois Federation of Teachers combined to spend more than $200,000 against each. Other unions also pitched in. Much in the way Bailey's close margin against Bost may encourage a rematch in 2 years, the lopsided numbers here may discourage the unions from future meddling in southeastern Illinois. Unless they like setting money on fire, that is. Third point, warning signs for Trump and Biden in Illinois results. Both President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump easily defeated primary challengers. The contests were more formality, as both have already clinched enough delegates to secure their party's nominations for president. But within the numbers, there are some warning signs for each. Trump scored just over 80% in the statewide Republican vote, but in suburban DuPage and Lake counties, he only won about 72%, while former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley secured about 22%. The results continue a trend of weakness for Trump in the suburbs. Though Illinois is not a competitive general election state, Chicago's suburbs share some similarities with those outside Detroit, Milwaukee, and Philadelphia, which will be pivotal in deciding the race. Biden, on the other hand, won more than 90% of the statewide vote, but in the city of Chicago, about a quarter of Democratic primary voters either voted for someone else or skipped the race altogether. Per unofficial results, Biden secured about 89% of city residents who voted in the presidential race, but about 14.3% who pulled the Democratic primary ballot left the presidential race blank. Again, Biden is highly likely to win Illinois in the general election. But if even a fraction of the Democrat base sits out in November, some key states could swing the other direction. The turnout is abysmal, but not necessarily a pattern. It's too early to get an official statewide number, but primary election turnout across the state was atrocious, and for good reason. Major party presidential nominations have all but been decided, and there were no other statewide races on the ballot cycle. For voters who did show up, there were few choices to make. Putting aside the top of the ticket, voters in most parts of the state saw few contested races. This was perhaps partly to be expected, given the state of the presidential race and the institutional advantages incumbent lawmakers have in most primary elections. The Speaker Welch flexes his muscle. State Representative Mary Flowers, a Democrat from Chicago, has served in the Illinois House since 1985. She's the longest-serving African-American lawmaker in state history. On Tuesday, she lost her primary by more than a 2-to-1 margin. It was a defeat that, in a twist of irony, was engineered by House Speaker Chris Welch, a Democrat from Hillside, the first black person in state history to lead that chamber. That's a summary of the Illinois primaries. Happened last week. We'll throw it back to Carol for the obituaries.
Thank you, Jeff. There is just one obituary today. It's for Eric Frederick Lorscheider, 53, of Ozark, Missouri. Left us too soon on March 19th, 2024. Eric was born in New Jersey in 1971 to Frederick and Barbara Lorscheider and grew up in Bettendorf, Iowa. Eric graduated Assumption High School in 1989 before graduating from St. Ambrose University in 1994 with a degree in theater design and technology. That led him to an almost 30-year career at the Soji Tabuchi Theater. His passion for tinkering in his laboratory has left his mark in many other theaters, productions, and landmarks in Branson and beyond. He is survived by his wife, Amy Lorscheider, daughter Lindsay Lorscheider, son Grant, and wife Brooke Lorscheider, granddaughter Magnolia, his bonus daughters, Tori and Jacob Van Dyke, and Emily Kostreba, his mother, Barbara Wadsworth Lorscheider, sister Arlene, and husband Brian Anderson, and nephews John and Trent. Eric was preceded in death by his father, Frederick Lorscheider. A funeral service will be held at 1 p.m., Monday, March 25th, 2024, at Adams Funeral Home in Ozark. Burial will follow at Vaughn Oddfellow Cemetery in Ozark. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., immediately before the funeral at the funeral home. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made directly to the family. And that's https://www.gofundme.com/f/YFWCT. ERICS funeral expenses. Jeff?
Turning now to the opinion page for today. Starts with a political cartoon of a pretty muscle-bound looking Uncle Sam in wrestling tights in an arena. And he's taking down a mobile phone with a TikTok app showing on the screen. The title of today's opinion section is TikTok Takedown. The first article, Banning App Would Stifle Free Speech. It's written by Sean McCutcheon, who was the successful plaintiff in the 2014 Supreme Court case McCutcheon versus the FEC, which struck down aggregate limits on campaign financing. He wrote this for InsideSources.com. Banning app would stifle free speech. The recent move by the House of Representatives to advance legislation forcing ByteDance to divest its ownership of TikTok represents a potentially alarming infringement on our fundamental rights guaranteed by the First Amendment. Despite national security concerns, coercing the divestment of TikTok sets a dangerous precedent that undermines the principle of free expression. While it's undeniable that there are legitimate concerns about the security implications of foreign-owned platforms accessing some data of millions of Americans, curtailing access to TikTok based on these concerns constitutes an overreach of governmental authority. The current ban on TikTok on federal devices is a reasonable precaution, but the government restricting access to the platform for the public goes too far, and it is a decision for parents of those under the age of 18. Former President Donald Trump's reversal of his previous advocacy for banning TikTok is motivated by fears of Meta, that is Facebook and Instagram, becoming even more powerful. He has a political point, but not a constitutional one. His recent flip-flop on this issue underscores the political nature of such decisions. But the motivations behind the legislation should not overshadow the potential erosion of individual liberties and the consequences they entail. Proponents of the legislation argue it does not amount to a ban, citing the assertion by U.S. Representative Mike Gallagher, Republican from Wisconsin, that the TikTok user experience can continue and improve if ByteDance no longer owns the company. Yet, the looming threat of a ban if ByteDance fails to comply underscores the coercive nature of the proposed measures. They really have no choice based on the threatened consequence. Moreover, the absence of concrete evidence demonstrating the Chinese Communist Party's use of TikTok for surveillance or propaganda raises questions about the necessity of such drastic actions. While it is conceivable that Beijing could exploit TikTok for nefarious purposes, it is essential to weigh these potential risks against the broader principles of free speech and individual autonomy. Banning TikTok violates the free speech rights of millions of Americans, especially young people just learning to find their voices and form opinions. This may be why President Joe Biden has indicated support for the divestment legislation while simultaneously having an account for his campaign on the platform. Hypocritical and political can be synonyms. While TikTok may not be a beacon of free speech in its home country, or even allowed there, the United States has long prided itself on its commitment to protecting the rights of its citizens to express themselves freely, even when it conflicts with governmental interests. The use of lawsuits to hold social media companies accountable for violating laws is a more appropriate course of action. But the protection afforded to these companies under Section 230 of the Federal Communications Law shields them from many legal challenges, limiting the effectiveness of this approach. If social media companies were subject to the same legal scrutiny as other entities, they might be more willing to prioritize the interests of their users over their own corporate agendas. Let's open TikTok and other platforms to this level of legal scrutiny and see how quickly they clean up their act. And maybe big tech, with all its money, should build better free speech applications and get out of the business of policing speech. Furthermore, the potential for government overreach in restricting access to social media platforms sets a dangerous precedent. Granting authorities the power to ban or control speech based on vague notions of national security could pave the way for future censorship and suppression of dissenting voices. While the concerns raised by proponents of legislation targeting TikTok are not without merit, the proposed solutions risk undermining the very freedoms they purport to protect. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And a second opinion, also about TikTok takedown. This one is entitled Congress Right to Seek Chinese Divestment, and it is written by Mark Montgomery, who is a senior fellow and senior director of the Center for Cyber and Technology Innovation at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. So here's what he has to say. The Chinese Communist Party in Beijing is nervous, and it ought to be. The U.S. Congress has targeted a significant tool, the CCP, which stands for Chinese Communist Party, targeted the significant tool the CCP uses to spread disinformation among Americans, and the rulers in Beijing are not happy about it. The House has voted to require TikTok to be divested from Chinese ownership. The proposal would not ban TikTok, as its often well-paid critics charge. nor would it limit free speech. TikTok, of course, is a popular app that millions of Americans use to promote their companies and reach new audiences. It's harmless, you might say. Only, it isn't. The app is owned by the Chinese company ByteDance, which is under CCP control. Beijing has an iron grasp over the platform's algorithm and all user data. Your data. That is a major U.S. national security risk. Remember, this is the Chinese government that stole millions of American government and military officials' records held by the Office of Personnel Management. Chinese leaders cannot be trusted with access to an even greater number of Americans' personal data on TikTok, which could allow them to attempt to influence U.S. elections. According to respected international human rights organizations, the Chinese government is, quote, waging a targeted campaign against Uyghur women, men, and children, unquote, and conducting human rights abuses that include coercive population control methods, forced labor, arbitrary detention in internment camps, torture, physical and sexual abuse, mass surveillance, family separation, and repression of cultural and religious expression. Of even greater concern is the disinformation and manipulation campaign the CCP is already running on the TikTok platform, which could potentially accelerate into a contingency or conflict between the United States and China. A group of Rutgers University researchers have demonstrated that the app promotes CCP interests, and they see a strong possibility that content on TikTok is either amplified or suppressed based on its alignment with the interest of the Chinese government. By comparing the volume of TikTok posts with those of Instagram, you can see how access to views on issues such as the Russian invasion of Ukraine and Hamas's attack on Israel October 7th are manipulated to help Chinese national security interests. This algorithmic manipulation is even clearer when applied to sensitive political topics in China, such as the Tiananmen Square massacre, the Uyghur genocide, and Hong Kong. Knowing this, lawmakers in Congress passed a bipartisan bill to divest TikTok from its Chinese parent company, ByteDance. The legislation now heads to Senate for action. The bill requiring Chinese divestment is a balanced and feasible solution that safeguards innovation, strengthens U.S. national security, protects investors in the app, and keeps private information from being collected by the CCP. This divestment ensures that American users can enjoy TikTok for creative expression and to grow and market their business, but under new ownership that respects U.S. laws and values. This is not about stifling speech. It is about keeping China from suppressing free speech. The CCP has established counterintelligence laws that give it unfettered access to data held by Chinese companies and openly practices its preference for state sovereignty over personal privacy. The CCP does not adhere to core American principles such as free speech and assembly. Divesting TikTok from ByteDance ensures the platform can continue operating in the United States free from Beijing's influence and without impeding individual Americans' rights to express themselves. Beijing is not taking this lying down. ByteDance has an immense lobbying machine in Washington. Congress is right to end Beijing's effort to sow political discord in the United States and harvest Americans' personal data. The House was right to pass divestment legislation, as was President Joe Biden's pledge that he will sign it. Now, it's up to the Senate to protect America from China's malign influence. Jeff?
Wow. two compelling arguments. Let's turn to sports. Here's what's on TV today. If you haven't had enough basketball, the college women's NCAA tournament has 8 games on, all on ESPN, starting at 1 o'clock, Ole Miss at Notre Dame, then at 3, Tennessee at North Carolina State, at 5 o'clock, Syracuse at UConn, and 5:30, Oklahoma at Indiana. Then at 7, West Virginia at Carver Hawkeye Arena to face Caitlin Clark and the Iowa Hawkeyes. This will be, of course, their last game at Carver Hawkeye, or her last game at Carver Hawkeye. At 7:30, Creighton is at UCLA. At 9 o'clock, Kansas at USC. And at 9:30, Utah at Gonzaga. There's a college women's lacrosse game on ESPNU at 3:30, Northwestern at North Carolina. And NBA basketball on NBA TV, 6:30, Boston and Atlanta. Then at 7 on NBC Sports is Washington at Chicago. And at 9 o'clock, NBA TV is Philadelphia at Sacramento. Hockey, NHL, Vegas at St. Louis is on at 7 on NHL Network. And baseball, we've got spring training baseball at noon, the New York Mets at New York Yankees, that's on MLB, on Marquee. At 3 o'clock, the Chicago Cubs versus St. Louis Cardinals, always an interesting matchup. And also on MLB Network at 7 o'clock, the mighty Boston Red Sox at Texas. Soccer, we've got Azerbaijan versus Bulgaria at 11 o'clock on FS2. Then at 1 o'clock, Sweden versus Albania. Tennis, there's a 10 a.m. match with the ATP and WTA in Miami. Over to you, Carol.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. Quad City Storm. Storm enjoyed another successful road trip. 2 more wins and banking 5 of a possible 6 points in a 3-game road swing made for a nice weekend for the Quad City Storm. There was also some franchise history set as Leif Mattsson took over the Storm franchise record for points in a season. After a win and overtime setback at 4th place and defending SPHL champion Roanoke, the Storm capped the weekend with Sunday's solid 6-3 victory over the Knoxville Ice Bears at the Knoxville Civic Coliseum. Quad City coach Dave Pazinski said, "The guys got lucky over the weekend. There were a couple of one-on-ones that went our way." With the weekend's action in the books, the 8 playoff teams have been determined for next month's Presidential Cup playoffs. With the 5 points, now sitting with 30 victories, the Storm is 30-21-1-0, 61 points. They moved into 5th place with 4 games left, all against 2nd place Peoria Riverman over the next 2 weekends. The Storm are chasing 4th place Fayetteville, who are 29-17-6-0, 64 points, for potential home ice advantage in the playoffs opening round. Quad Cities is also just 2 games shy of the Storm franchise record of 32 wins set in the 2021 and 22 playoff season. In Sunday's victory, Cole Galka had his 2nd 2-goal game of the weekend and added an assist up to his season point total of 50 points. Galka is 3rd on the team in points behind Mattsson, who has 26 goals, 31 assists, and 57 points, and Matt Yastowski, who has 27 goals, 26 assists, and 53 points. Mattsson set the Storm franchise record of 57 points on Sunday as he assisted on the first 3 goals, 2 of those by Galka, before scoring his 26th of the season in a 4-goal second period that gave Quad Cities a 5-1 lead. The 24-year-old Mattsson overtook Shane Bennett's franchise mark of 56 set in the 2021 and 22 campaign. Galka atop the offense for the weekend with 4 goals, as he also scored twice in Friday's 4-3 victory over Roanoke at the Berglund Center. Philip Virgil scored his 8th of the season in that victory, and Mason Emhoff added his 4th. Saturday's rematch against the Real Yard Dogs was a defensive affair, as Quad City netminder Brent Moran, who is 19-10-1-0, stopped 25 of 27 Roanoke shots. However, he couldn't stop Quad Cities from suffering its first overtime setback of the season, as Alex DiCarlo scored his 10th of the season at the 2:38 mark of overtime to decide that contest. On Sunday, Quad City had 5 players find the back of the net. In addition to Galka and Mattson, Waylon Parrish had 5, Tyler Van Uden had 2, and Captain Tommy Sisko had 11, also scored. It was the second straight game that Sisko has scored, and he put up Quad City's only tally on Saturday. Parrish and Galka's 2nd came on power play chances. Netminder Bailey Birkin evened his season record at 6-6-0-0 as he stopped 29 of 32 Ice Bears shots. The Storm returns home this week to host Peoria on Friday and Saturday. Puck drop both nights is at 7:10. Jeff, back to you.
Well, here's a preview of tonight's NCAA Women's Championship game. Iowa and West Virginia offer contrasting styles. Monday night's winner will advance to the Sweet 16. Iowa and West Virginia have combined for 55 wins this season, but have gone about it in different ways. The 30-4 Hawkeyes are number one in the country in scoring with 92.8 points per game, while the Mountaineers, whose record is 25-7, rank 2nd in the Big 12 in points allowed, 57.8. West Virginia ranks 2nd in the country in forcing turnovers, 23.97. No team passes the ball better than the Hawkeyes, who rank number 1 in assists, 21.9, per game, and are 3rd in turnover ratio. Something will have to give Monday night, with the winner earning a spot in the Sweet 16 next weekend in Albany. The 7 p.m. tip will be broadcast on ESPN. "This is the elite offense in the country," said West Virginia head coach Mark Kellogg. "The way they run their offense is probably a little bit different, and obviously Caitlin is special, but they are really talented around her. They just play with this freedom on the offensive end." The Hawkeyes scored 91 points in their win on Saturday against Holy Cross, a top 15 defensive team nationally. However, nobody in the Iowa camp was thrilled with the performance, calling it rusty. I was a little frustrated, but I feel like that comes from knowing what it takes to be where we want to be," said Caitlin Clark, who missed her 18th career triple-double by just 2 rebounds. "I think from here on out, every single team is going to give us a really good game. Every single team is basically a top 25 team at this point. That's what makes March so much fun." West Virginia's style is to create chaos with its press. It's been a winning formula they don't plan on messing with now. "Honestly, like we've been doing all year, like we feed off transition baskets, steals, deflections. So we're not going to change anything," said sophomore guard Jordan Harrison, who averages 2.97 steals per game, 12th most in the country. "We're going to do what West Virginia does, and that's get turnovers, regardless who the team is." Monday night's game is sure to be an emotional one for Clark and fellow senior Kate Martin. It'll be the final game inside Carver Hawkeye Arena. For Martin, it will be her 160th game in black and gold, 3rd most behind Gabby Marshall with 161 and Monica Sinano at 162. "We keep talking about you. You know, we only have one more game left in Carver now," said Martin, who had 15 points and 12 rebounds in Saturday's victory. So we're trying to enjoy every single moment, and that puts things in perspective for us. It'll be in front of another sellout crowd. Every arena the Hawkeyes have played in this season, home or road, has been filled to capacity. Tournament settings have been partially productive for the Hawkeyes. In the last two sessions, Iowa is 16-2 in tournament games. Giving the near 15,000 scream what they want is the goal, Clark said. Keeping the season going offers even greater motivation. I feel like this city has really embraced our team more than anybody, said Clark, the NCAA's all-time leading scorer with 3,798 points. This state has really embraced our team, and they love our team to death, and that's what's made it so fun. That's what's made this journey is really all about, is people really rallying around us and sharing in these moments and this joy with us. And that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today, Monday, the 25th of March, 2024. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been the wonderful Carol Lockard. You can listen to Iris programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.